This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although he became a famous and influential poet after his death, the British writer and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins was never published in his lifetime. He died in 1889 at the age of 44. For several years, he renounced poetry because he believed it was in conflict with the life of a priest. His silence as a poet was broken after he read about a shipwreck in December 1875 that killed 5 German nuns. It inspired his famous poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland. My guest Ron Hansen has written a new historical novel based on the life of Gerard Manley Hopkins called Exiles. One of the novels Hansen is best known for, Marriott in Ecstasy, is about a young nun in the early 1900s. Hansen is Catholic and recently became a deacon. He teaches at Santa Clara University. He's also the author of The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a movie that played last year and starred Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck. Ron Hansen, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, I'd like to have you read a short excerpt of your novel, Exiles. Would you like to just set it up for us?
Yes, this is early in Hopkins' career when he was a Jesuit and he was not yet a priest. He was studying theology in Wales, and he came across this account of a shipwreck, the Deutschland, off the east coast of England. And he woke up with the sound of the wreck of the Hesperus sounding in his ears, and he realized that's not the kind of poetry he wanted to write, even though Longfellow's famous poem was widely known throughout the world. But after he woke up, I get into something of Hopkins' background. The scruples to which he was prey caused Hopkins to consider the worldly pursuit of poetry writing in conflict with his vocation to the priesthood. Just before entering the Society of Jesus in 1868, Hopkins resolved to pen no more verse unless his religious superiors requested it. And in a theatrical act of renunciation, he incinerated some copies of his Oxford poems in a secret ceremony that he inconspicuously noted in his journal simply as the slaughter of the innocents. And that act of renunciation was confirmed for him when, as a novice Jesuit, he was urged to relinquish disordered attachments that would impede his freedom and availability for a variety of ministries as well as tempt him to the sin of pride. Since then, he'd written only the slightest kinds of poetry, joshing doggerel to entertain at picnics or Latin greeting card verse for visiting dignitaries. And yet, there was always an interior and hard to quell, and yet.
So do you think that that the Jesuit order would have wanted him to renounce poetry? Was this something that he just felt obliged to do?
I think it was his own feeling, because certainly the Jesuits were writing poetry. They had a magazine that published poetry. So I think it was just the fact that he was a convert made him extra earnest and probably more constrained in his feelings about what a priest is like and what a poet is like and how they're kind of indivisible.
And why did he feel he had to renounce his poems and burn them in a secret ceremony?
I think it was in a secret ceremony just because he realized it was kind of a maudlin gesture. And we don't really know to what extent this was a complete renunciation of poetry, because there's certainly a lot of fragments and poems that exist from his Oxford days. So somebody had copies of them. I don't know who. So it seems like it was more of a gesture more than a real complete incineration of all of his work.
So, you know, there's this shipwreck that kills 5 nuns who were leaving Germany for the United States, where they intended to work with the poor. And he's so moved by their deaths that he decides to write a poem about it, even though he's renounced the writing of poetry. And as you mentioned, he has the sound of the wreck of the Hesperus, Longfellow's famous poem, in his head. And you say he thinks that's kind of corny. I mean, that's not the word he uses.
Exactly.
But read one verse of it for us. Give us a sense of what Hopkins didn't like.
Yeah, the Wreck of the Hesperus has a stanza that goes, "She struck where the white and fleecy waves looked soft as carded wool, but the cruel rocks, they gored her side like the horns of an angry bull. Her rattling shrouds all sheathed in ice with a mast went by the board. Like a vessel of glass, she stove and sank. Ho, ho, the breakers roared.
Right, kind of sing-song.
Yes, it is. And I had the impression that Hopkins would have heard that ho-hoing in his mind when he was sleeping. And it was exactly the kind of prose or verse that he was trying to avoid. And he wanted to have a verse that mimicked the sound of human speech, and was really more prose-like, but actually had the same elevated language. And that's why his poetry is so difficult, because he did lots of inventions and new experiments in poetry, and insisted on having real packed words, imagery that was sometimes hard to figure out at first, but was ultimately very powerful.
Let me ask you now to read a stanza of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem about the wreck of the Deutschland, in which 5 nuns were killed, and we'll compare the language of Longfellow and okay. Hopkins.
This is stanza 17. The Deutschland has sailed from Bremen in early December, and it encounters what is called the Kentish Knock. It's an undersea island of sand that the ship founders on. And it seems as if they're going to be rescued, but the waves are too high, and then the tide rises up, and pretty soon everybody is being assaulted by these giant waves. The ship essentially becomes a reef of its own. And Hopkins picks up with that on the night of December 6th, where he writes, "They fought with God's cold, and they could not, and fell to the deck, crushed them, or water, and drowned them, or rolled with the sea romp over the wreck. Night roared with the heartbreak hearing, a heartbroke rabble, the woman's wailing, the crying of a child without check, till a lioness arose, breasting the babble, a prophetess towered in the tumult, a virginal tongue told."
Who's the prophetess?
That's the tall nun. Sister Barbara was seen to have peeked her head out through this window that was being assaulted by all this wave, and cried out, "Oh Christ, come quickly." And there were those people who wrote about this who said that she was dejected, but the London Times wrote of it in a much more positive way, of a person seeking intercession from Jesus. And I think that's what really struck Hopkins and made him want to write the poem.
You know, Hopkins referred to his own style of writing as sprung rhythm.
Yes.
What did he mean by that, and can you hear it in what you just read?
Well, what he did was count stresses. For example, we have an iambic verse where you have a stress and an unstressed, and then we have other kinds, anapest, dactyls. But what he would do is the stressed part of a word, and he would use it with like a childhood rhyme, like "Hi diddly dee, the banker's life for me," where you hear the various stressed parts of each of those words and just disregard the other ones. So he invented this thing called sprung rhythm for some reason to give much more of the value and power of human speech.
So it wasn't like iambic pentameter where it'd have to be accented, unaccented, accented,
right.
Unaccented syllable.
Yeah, so his lines were of an even length and an even number of stresses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was a fan of a lot of Greek verse, and he also learned from the Welsh, a Welsh form of chiming, they called it. And he combined his love of Greek verse with the Welsh and came up with this idea of sprung rhythm. But he didn't write real poetry for about 7 years, and during that time he was coming up with this concept of what a new kind of verse could be.
The nuns who were killed in the shipwreck on a stormy sea that that Hopkins writes about, these are nuns who were leaving Germany in part to do their mission in America, but in part because the Chancellor Otto von Bismarck was cracking down on Catholics. There were crackdowns against Catholics in various parts of Europe during this time in the mid-1800s. And what was it about the story of these 5 nuns that moved Hopkins so much that he wanted to renounce his renunciation of poetry and actually start writing again?
Well, I think he thought of himself as an exile as well, that when he converted to Catholicism while at Oxford University, it meant that he was essentially giving up any chance of being a fellow of the college because there were rules against Roman Catholics doing that. Also, his family disapproved of his conversion, and he felt somewhat exiled from them. It's remarkable to me that his mother and father never visited him all the time that he was a Jesuit, except on his deathbed. And I think that that was kind of a persistent feeling of his, that he had been ostracized by family, friends, and by his school, and knew that there was going to be certain privations he was going to have to suffer through for the rest of his life based on his religious conviction.
You know, Hopkins renounced writing, but at some point continued to write anyways. You said in an interview back in 2005 in Sojourners magazine, "I write about faith because writing for me is a form of prayer." How do you reconcile your sense, you know, of writing as a form of prayer with Hopkins' sense that the life of prayer that he had dedicated himself to was incompatible with poetry?
Well, I think Hopkins was wrong, and I think he came to realize that his poetry was a form of prayer. And certainly a lot of people use his poetry now as a at least a start of their prayer and inspiration for it. You see, in the year that he is ordained, he writes some of his greatest poetry, like God's Grandeur and Pied Beauty and The Wind Hover. And each of those is kind of a reflection of how his theological concerns ultimately get reflected in nature.
You seem to be very interested in earlier periods for nuns and priests. You know, you write about Gerard Manley Hopkins, who became a Jesuit priest in the 1800s. Your earlier novel, Marriott in Ecstasy, is about a young woman who becomes a nun in the early 1900s. What interests you about what the religious life would have been like at a much earlier time?
I think it's a little less complicated. And also, I can master a historical period to a certain extent, and everything I say will be believed because I've done the research. Whereas if I'm talking about a contemporary period, I think people all have their own opinions about what was going on and might think I had it wrong in some way. But I think primarily, as when I was writing my books in the Old West, it seemed like the coloring was more bright. The situations were starker, so that the elemental questions rose to the surface more than they do where so much is going on in the busyness of our lives in the contemporary world.
My guest is novelist Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of the poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. You are now a deacon in the Catholic Church. You were ordained as a deacon last year. When did religion become a serious part of your life?
I think it always was. I went to parochial schools for grade school and went to a Jesuit high school and college. So I always had the very strong influence of the Jesuit priests who became my friends. And like a lot of Catholic boys, I anticipated becoming a priest at one time, and then the whole problem of celibacy dissuaded me. The idea of being a deacon didn't enter my mind until around the year 2000, and then I inquired about it and got into the program, just simply because I became a Eucharistic minister or lector, and I found that all those ministries nourished me in some way. And I found, since becoming a deacon, where I celebrate weddings and preach and so forth, that it's an exhilarating experience helping these people in the high points of their lives or their down points as well. It's wonderful to walk hand in hand with them and see what the Spirit is doing to them or doing through them.
In addition to writing novels about faith, you've also written about criminals. You have two books about gangs in the West, one about the Dalton Gang and one about Jesse James's gang. And you wrote the book, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, that was adapted into a movie that opened last year that starred Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck. It was a really good film. You've talked about why you're interested in writing about religion and why you are a man of faith yourself. What about Western gangs?
I think I'm really interested in outlaws and outsiders, people who were marginalized, people who look at the normal world from a vantage point that's somewhat different, who've adopted different strategies to live by. And I think that's what unites the outlaws with the nuns and whoever else I write about. And I think that in some ways that's the artist's perspective on the world. Most writers and artists I know feel like they're somehow outside the normal life and kind of are spies looking in on what other people are doing, but recognize that they don't have a quotidian life themselves. It's quite different than that. Also, as I said, I like the idea of the elemental forces at work when you're dealing with criminals, especially those of the 19th century. These outlaws who took the frontier rugged individualism to its extreme and just decided to do what was best for them and not for other people. And it's fascinating for me to see where that comes from, what kinds of worldviews these people have that allow them to take money from other people or kill other people seemingly thoughtlessly.
A lot of it has been written about Jesse James, but your novel is more about Robert Ford, who assassinated, you know, who killed Jesse James. Why did you want to write about Robert Ford more than Jesse James?
It struck me as a Shakespearean tragedy on the order of Julius Caesar that a young person somehow ingratiated himself with this famous outlaw, so much so that Jesse invited him into his company and into his own home. And then Bob Ford felt compelled eventually to kill Jesse James. He had at one point made an agreement with the governor to capture Jesse James, but then the governor gave him the permission to shoot him if it was necessary, because it seemed apparent to a lot of the law officials at the time that Jesse James was riding around killing off anybody else who would possibly turn him into the government. He had become paranoid. It was kind of a rehearsal of what The Sopranos was all about, a person afraid of what is going to happen to him, so he tries to eliminate any opposition or any person who would turn him in.
From what you've read in history, how much of Ford's interest in killing Jesse James was to collect the bounty on his head, and how much was just to make a name for himself?
It was the latter. I don't think the money meant that much to him. So I think Charlie Ford, who is the only one I can remember actually saying he did it for the reward money, I think that was important for him. But
Charlie Ford was Robert's brother, who was a member of the James Gang.
Exactly. And both Charlie and Bob were living in the house in St. Joseph, Missouri, when Jesse was shot by Bob. I think they were both afraid that they're going to be tried and convicted of various crimes. And they were both afraid that Jesse James was so paranoid that he was going to try and kill them. And so they had extra motivation to see him done away with. And that seemed to be a kind of a cat and mouse game, almost a dance with death that Jesse was entertaining with Bob. And especially when he decided to take off his guns and present his back to Bob. And there was only time but Bob had ever seen him without a gun in his hand or nearby. And he decided to take that opportunity to kill him.
Your book about Robert Ford is in part about the nature of celebrity. Jesse James was a celebrity in his time for being an outlaw, and then Robert Ford became a celebrity for shooting Jesse James. In fact, and anyone who's seen the movie will remember this, Robert Ford, after he assassinates Jesse James, ends up reenacting the shooting on stage every night in the theater, and that's how he makes his living.
Right.
It's just kind of bizarre. Who knew something like that happened then? I mean, what year are we talking?
This was 1882. Mm-hmm. And I think he did something like 800 performances in 1 year. And the performance was called How I Killed Jesse James. And I don't think there's any surviving script of that. So I kind of made it up. But it was basically Charlie Ford acting as Jesse James and standing up there dusting off a picture and Bob Ford shooting him in the back. And for a while, Bob Ford was heralded as this hero. And then eventually that song that was made by Billy Gashade came around, where it talked about the dirty little coward who shot Mr. Howard. And the attention turned on Bob as a coward and a villain, and he was eventually chased off the stage and headed out west.
Was it the play itself that turned the image against him and made him seem like a coward, because people who saw the show would see that Jesse James had turned his back to Ford and that he'd taken off his gun. So Ford shot an unarmed man in the back.
I think that's probably it, yeah. It's odd, though, because nobody seemed to have the same feeling about Jesse James shooting somebody in the back. They treated Jesse as something of a hero. But I think, as you say, it's about celebrity. And they missed having Jesse James around, missed having the subject of these kinds of comic books. He was kind of a source of vitality for a lot of these people. The world seemed paler with him gone.
My guest is novelist Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hansen wrote the novel The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a film last year. You know, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I watched a lot of Westerns and movies and on TV, and for a while it was my ambition to be a cowgirl someday, which is probably the most ludicrous thing in the world that, you know, a kid in Brooklyn would be imagining. Did you grow up with a lot of Westerns?
I didn't grow up with Westerns, but I grew up with a grandfather who was alive in 1865, and He knew people who were still wearing their Civil War greatcoats, and he was out in Colorado. He had the first indoor bathroom in his house, and he had horses, and he had hired hands and all that. So I knew kind of that milieu. And where I grew in Omaha, I could drive only 10 minutes and be out in a rural area or in wilderness. We used to play as boys in an area that was reputed to be a hideout for the James gang after the Northfield, Minnesota raid. Jesse James, shortly before his death, was planning on buying a farm in Nebraska, and that was only about an hour from where I lived. So I felt I knew the area and knew what kind of people these guys were. Partly because my grandfather said he actually met the James gang at one time. And he, among all the people I've heard say that, he was the only person in the right place at the right time to have actually encountered them. But so I grew up with those legends, and it seemed very familiar to me.
What was your grandfather's memory of meeting the James gang?
He was a young man, actually probably a boy, and they had come up to the farm he was on to water their horses. And then they heard hooves off in the distance, and they immediately got on their horses and ran off. And that was the last he saw them. But he knew that they must have been desperate to run off at the sound of hooves. Nobody else would have.
You're somebody who seems to want a sense of community, the community of family, the community of the church, the community of the college where you teach, unlike the characters we've just discussed.
Yeah, I think in some ways, when you're writing, you're imagining another life. In fact, that's one of my favorite things to do still as a daydreamer, is to sit around and think of another life, what it would be like if I had been an Air Force pilot or if I was a doctor or a lawyer. I think when you're in your room writing things, you're just dreaming of another form of you. And it'll be imbued by a lot of your qualities, but it'll be a person who has challenged himself or taken risks to go in a different direction. And that's a way of exercising your imagination.
It almost sounds like you have a twin brother.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was going to ask you if you imagine a path not taken, looking at your brother's life, knowing that he's an identical twin, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, so you have an identical twin who's headed in a different direction than you have.
Right.
It sounds like, you know, seeing his life is very similar to like imagining an alternate life.
Yeah, I remember as a really young kid standing in front of a mirror with my brother and being confused by it because I couldn't tell which reflection was which. And I think that that's probably the start of my writing career, probably, is realizing that it's a way of individuating yourself is to write, but it's also a way of becoming somebody else simultaneously.
Do you actually talk about that with each other, the kind of confusion that you had looking at each other, knowing that you looked identical but were different?
We never really talked about it. We've certainly experienced it, though. And I remember the sense of outrage I had as a young boy when people couldn't tell us apart. So it'd be like, there's John, there's Jerry, and there's the twins. So we didn't really have separate names because people would confuse us. And that was hard for me. And I think I struggled under that burden for several years. And then finally we did kind of go our separate ways and we are not confused anymore.
Do you still look alike? Or has time changed you sufficiently?
Time changes you. He's involved in business. I'm involved in teaching. And I think that makes it, you look different automatically.
Ron Hanson, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ron Hanson's new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of the British poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins.